Hello. For this episode of the Uber Brand podcast, I went to Durham, North Carolina, and the headquarters of Burt's Bees, the brand that is famous for its honey and wax-based products, the lip balm in particular, and for Burt, that enigmatic man on the logo. But as we will hear from Jim Geike, it was really a woman, Roxanne Quimby, who was the brains and energy behind making Burt's Bees a leader in the natural beauty space. And Jim should know, he is the general manager of the business today and a VP at Clorox, the parent company since 2007. Beyond talking the mission and myth of Burt's Bees, we'll also be talking about what makes the business buzz despite a 300% price premium and no discounts compared to its competitors, when to say no to the easy way forward, how to balance the needs of brand, parent company, and consumer, who works at Burt's Bees, why and how do they join, and why Jim thinks ownership of mission-driven brands by large corporations is not only the norm by now, but actually a good model for everyone involved. I encourage you to check out the podcast notes on uberbrands.com, that's spelled uberbrands.com, to see the pictures I took of the beautiful headquarters in an old tobacco warehouse here, including beehive and all, and to see Burt's hut that was being rebuilt in front of it while I was visiting. And don't forget to comment, rate, and review. Your interest and engagement is what keeps us going. Enjoy.
Please listen carefully.
Welcome, everyone, to this new episode of the Uber Brands podcast, in which we talk about Uber brands, brands that seduce rather than sell, that create myth in addition to the material and shine from the inside out. We call them Uber brands, and we, that is your host, JP Kuhlwein, and occasional co-host and co-author, Wolfgang Schaefer. And today I'm here in Durham, North Carolina, at Burt's Bees headquarters with Jim Geike. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Jim is running the shop here. I think formerly is called the vice president and general manager of Burt's Bees. And he was kind enough to let us look literally behind the facade, I was just saying. And we just came off a little tour of the headquarters. Thanks again for having us here, Jim.
Thanks for coming to visit.
Burt's Bees, we didn't request this visit by mistake. Burt's Bees is a special kind of brand. What makes Burt's Bees special?
So the mission of Burt's Bees is to reconnect people to the wisdom, power, and beauty of nature.
Wow.
Full
okay.
Stop. It's very clear, and it's a very compelling mission, and a lot of people identify with that and want to learn more about it, and how that manifests into personal care products is you know what we're all about here. What makes Burt's Bees really special as a brand and business is a combination of two things, and we can talk about these in depth. It's this balance of authenticity plus personality or differentiation. And I think that the founder of this business back in 1984 really, really focused on that combination of authenticity plus differentiation. And it created a special brand. You can see it in the product development and the products that we have. And we continue to build off that platform today.
The founder actually was called Burt. He died in 2015, I think.
Yeah, there were two founders. A woman named Roxanne Quimby, who really was the brains behind this. She was a trained art student from the San Francisco Art Institute. And she met Burt Chavitz, in Maine back in the middle 80s. And she just really found a personality and identity to build a brand and a business around.
So he's more of the muse, actually.
He's the muse and the myth and the identity. And we love Burt because what Burt does for us is this perfect balance of personality plus principle.
Right. And so, he's this real quirky guy. You showed me a shack outside that you actually brought in from Maine. It's a really small shack. Other people would probably store their lawnmower in it. That's where he lived.
Yeah, Burt was born and raised in New York City, actually to a privileged family. And
he was a photographer, I think, for Time magazine.
He was a photographer, and his dad ran a very successful printing business. And Burt just realized early on that just wasn't the life that he wanted. And so he moved his way from New York City and ended up in Maine. And he just discovered a simple life. We use the Thoreau quote about, "I want to live a more simple existence and confront the realities of a natural life." And Bert lived in a 300 square foot turkey coop with a cast iron wood stove and an extension cord that he ran from a neighbor's house that had three outlets in it. And he could plug in a radio, a hot pot, and one other thing. And that's how he lived his life.
And he became a beekeeper. And that's, I guess, how the two got to meet.
Yeah. And Bert, he became fascinated in bees as a species and particularly how they work together. How, you know, they're born to do certain roles and the queen does something and the drones do something else and the worker bees do something else and how they work together as a sort of a society. He really became a student of how to work with them. And he became a trained beekeeper. And Bert, even at 80 years old, could walk up and pick up a whole hive of bees with his bare hand because he said if you really know what you're doing and you've got the right kind of energy, they know you're not there to hurt them and they'll work with you. And so he just had that. He had that special feel and attachment to bees. But on the other hand, he recognized it as a business. And Bert said, if I do this right and I live minimally, I can basically sell the honey that I get out of these bees and I don't have to work another day in my life.
He later was bought out and he didn't get too much money out of it. But people were surprised that he wasn't too upset about it because he seemed to want to just have enough money to live, right? And he didn't invest it in a big villa or whatever. In fact, he continued to live in this little shack.
And it's a long story, but the founders made a conscious decision to relocate the business from Maine to North Carolina in 1993, which she would argue is probably one of the smartest strategic decisions that she actually ever made because it put her more central for distributing.
That's Roxanne.
Yeah, and with access to a much more talented employee base. And then the third thing is it was just a much more entrepreneur-friendly state to do business in. And at the same time, she discontinued 75% of her revenue base. So she was in candles and stove polishes and sort of home cleaning products. She threw away 75% of her product line and decided to only focus on skincare at that point.
And why is that? Why that?
Because the margins were better and she enjoyed the product development on the skincare color, cosmetic side of the business more than she did in household products.
Moving your headquarters from Maine to here is quite a big event in a mission-based company. It seems like you have this constant balance between pragmatism and business development.
And that's what I love about my job. We wrestle with these decisions every day and none of them are black and white and none of them are, well, we're going to make this choice and it has no trade-offs on the other side. Everything comes with trade-offs. And so it's really about setting standards for a variety of things. And we could talk about packaging standards and natural formulation standards and operational standards that we have, which we say are non-negotiable floors. For us, doing the hard work to set the standards on those type of things actually gives you a degree of freedom to say, all right, this is the box that we're going to work within. You have complete freedom within that box.
We talked a lot about the product downstairs. You have a beautiful store there. Tell us a little bit about product as icon and how we still see the origin of Bert's Bees reflected and how it's also being continuously translated, I guess, and evolved.
Sure. So our most iconic product is our beeswax lip balm. It's the thing that we're most noted for. When people find out I work for Bert's Bees, I get two questions. First of all, they hold up their fingers about 3 inches apart and they say, I love your chapstick, which is somebody else's brand,
right,
first of all.
Right.
But it's become the default name for the category. And then the second thing is they ask if there's really a Bert. And so it gives us an opportunity to talk about, you know, Bert's real and here's what he stood for. And we talk about him a lot. But the iconic product we love for a lot of different reasons. First of all, it's 100% natural product. People either really love it or they really don't like it because it's peppermint-based. It's really tingly.
It's peppermint-based.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And okay. So it can leave a tingling sort of effervescent feeling on your lips, which people either love or they don't love. And then the second thing is because of the waxes and oils that we use, it can be waxy on your lips. And people, again, either love it or don't love it. And most people try to formulate their product to appeal to the masses. We actually don't mind a little polarization, which means if you rank our products on a scale of 1 to 5, as long as we have as many fives as we have ones, we know we're in good shape. Because the people that try it and say it's a 5 can't find anything else to substitute for it. Right. The people that say it's a 1, we say, thank you for trying it. I hope you find something that you love.
And we said it's almost like a mass premium item because on the one hand, it costs 3 times more than kind of the market, mass market leader. On the other hand, $3 is not a
fortune.
That's
exactly right. And that's the tension in what I would call price value, which I think is great. On one hand, the market leader is Chapstick by probably 6 market share points versus the number 2 brand, which now is Bert's Bees. And the average price is less than $1, whereas the average price on Bert's Bees is $3.
And you said the price never changes because you don't do price promotions.
We never do price promotion because for $3, you get a 100% natural product with beeswax that's sourced in an ethical way from farms in Tanzania, Africa, that is not petroleum-based and that will, you know, you'll use for 6 months or more until you either wash it or lose it.
Right. I saw the film about the sourcing in Tanzania. You're obviously quite proud about it and you feel like you want to tell the story. Is, and if yes, why is that important to your average consumer, let's say out here in Raleigh or in Durham or anywhere buying this product? And you're available very broadly. I can buy you at CVS and also at Whole Foods.
I think there have been two fundamental changes in this entire industry, which has allowed it to go from the fringes into more mainstream. And one of it is product development and the science behind these types of products, which we could talk about separately. The other thing is just the consumer enlightenment on how things get made is more important now than it's ever been. It cuts to, you know, the whole concept of corporate social responsibility. And Chobani actually has a tagline that we use a lot, how matters, right? So we've spent so much time in this industry of consumer products focused on features and benefits of products. And also the industry by and large for the past 25 years has focused on taking costs out, making things more efficient, reducing price. You know, it's shocking to me how high quality and low price things are in general. But there's also a school of thought, you know, you call it the unintended consequences of those types of decisions. There's a great book out there called The High Cost of Cheap Food, which is you can get a steak for $4 a pound. But if you knew what it cost for producers to produce that steak and sell it to you for $4 a pound, you might not like it. Right. So that concept translates into almost everything we do. And Chobani has done it great in yogurt with this very simple tagline of how matters. And we couldn't agree more. So the sources of your ingredients, the relationship between the growers and how that goes through the supply line, how products get manufactured and how companies run their operations is as important to this consumer base now as the features and benefits. And we love being part of the community of people that are doing it similarly. The Chobanis, the Seventh Generations, the Tom's Shoes. They can be in disparate categories other than personal care, but there's a common philosophy and approach to this which binds us all together.
I had an interview with Vincent Stanley of Patagonia, and he said, you can get fashion very cheaply, but really people in developing markets are paying the price for it, either in the environment or in low wages and social costs, etc. That's more or less what you're talking about. Yeah. So you say you kind of have some brothers out there in terms of spirit at Tom's and Chobani and other companies. Do you do something actively together to kind of convince other people in the industry or other industries of taking this approach?
We do a lot within the natural personal care segment. We have more in common with our competitors than we have differences. And we bind together, especially in North America, on things like product standards and things like that. So there's a lot of work that we do together because, you know, we say a rising tide lifts all ships. And so, you know, what's good for one of us is usually good for many of us. And where there's a common philosophy on ethical sourcing, on sustainable packaging and operations, and on natural products, we can debate nuances within that, and each of the brands have very, very different positionings. Like we talked about the positioning of a brand like Aesop versus Dr. Bronner in California, who's making a third generation Jewish soap maker who's making great washing soaps and personal cleansing products, and some of the German brands. And we have differences on brand positioning first and foremost, and point of view on organic material or not, point of view on vegan or not, point of view on GMOs or not. But in general, we are bound by values related to ethical sourcing, environmentally sustainable packaging and operations, and natural formulas.
And you're trying to be transparent, I guess it's a big part of your effort. You told me the story downstairs about saying 98% natural, and you're very proud of that. The packaging is made of recycled material, post-industrial, post-consumer, even the plastic packaging on the lipstick that we actually have here on the table. But then you also told me this anecdote about some consumers looking at that and saying, oh, it's only 98, probably other brands are 100%. How do you deal often with the fact that you put so much effort into it, but then people might perceive either that it's a standard or think that it's not trying hard enough?
Right. And it's a great issue, and we debate it. First of all, there are a subset of consumers that are willing to do the work and know the difference. And frankly, it's more believable and more important for those people to know and then to influence their people in their circles and spheres because they've done the work. They know what they're talking about for the most part.
We call them the design target. They're the real followers, the real fans.
They're the 1% bullseye who really have gone to that extraordinary depth to understand. They're very conscientious, deliberate choiceful shoppers.
How do you describe yours? Are there typical traits when it comes to the birds, bees, fans?
It's evolved over time. We used to love this term called LOHAS, L-O-H-A-S, yes. And it was a more popular, well-known term in Asia. It was lifestyles of health and sustainability. That used to be 0.5% of the population back in the 80s and 90s. Fondly, I call it the lunatic fringe. Those were the people that were doing that kind of work before that was popular work to do.
Right.
What's happened over the last 20 years is what they believed in has actually become popular.
Mainstream.
Roxanne, our founder, used to have this principle called what's popular is not always right and what's right is not always popular. But in the case of this industry that we happen to be working in, what's right, what we believe to be right, actually has become popular over time, which is what's happened to give it scale and momentum. But what's common to these people is that they just have a belief that how matters. And typically, what's happening as it evolves, we talk about lifestyles of health and sustainability. It's less about the sustainability and green living aspect of it, much more pronounced on the health and wellness side of it. So what really is common to most of our core consumers is a lifestyle which is dedicated to health and wellness, which includes things like managing stress, eating the right food, you know, getting the right amount of exercise. You'd be surprised at the overlap between people that do yoga regularly and that use our brand and our products. You know, these are the people that have made a lifestyle choice to reject chemicals, to buy things more local, to shop at the farmer's market, to live a more unprocessed, simpler life. They're willing to forego a little bit of convenience, or a lot of convenience actually, and a little bit of cost these days in order to live a life that they feel like works for them better.
So you said yourself that they might not be too much into the sustainability aspect of it. Nevertheless, you seem to be putting quite a bit of effort into it. You showed me even the bins here in the office.
In 2010, we became one of the first North Carolina companies that was designated zero waste to landfill.
Right. And, and you said you failed in 1 year when you had a product incident where you needed to scrap product. And,
right.
And it kind of, you struggle with that, but you know, you're trying to. So all of that is not really for the consumer then, I guess. It's not important to your consumer?
Well, it's an interesting question. So the designation of zero waste to landfill means that the entirety of your waste either has to be composted or recycled, or less than 10% of it has to go into a waste-to-energy stream, which means it gets incinerated, but then the ash from the incineration gets put into concrete blocks.
Right.
And so if you get above that 10%, you can no longer declare yourself zero waste to landfill. And we did have a manufacturing problem that we had more go to incineration that we were allowed. And so we're still working through that.
So why these efforts if that's not, I mean, if your consumers are on health?
And that's it's something that we've had to do to educate a lot of our corporate stakeholders in general, which is there are certain things that we do as a business because they're convictions that we hold dear that aren't necessarily going to be able to be tied to why the consumer's buying an individual product. But it does really have a big impact over the brand and the relationship between the consumers and the brand, because they believe that this brand and other brands like it are ones that are doing things the right way, and they want to spend their money with those types of companies that they deem to be more ethical and more responsible.
Right. So you're in a great building here. It used to be a warehouse where tobacco got dried, and it's completely revamped. And I'll put some pictures up on the website. You talk strongly about beliefs. You have a group that's all co-located, whether it's R&D, finance, marketing. When you talk about these beliefs, as I go out there and ask a couple of people, what are the things that might come out the most consistently about why they work here and not elsewhere?
We were speaking earlier. I've worked in portfolio companies for a lot of my career. The big advantage of this type of a business is the values and personality of the brand and the values and personality of the company are the same, right? Because we're not working in a multi-brand, multi-positioning kind of portfolio company. We're working in a single brand, a single equity, single culture, I guess, ecosystem, so to speak.
And
so
you're physically separated.
Our holding company, Clorox, is based in the Bay Area of Northern California, so Oakland, California, and we're here in North Carolina.
Are you organizationally separated as well, or is there, let's say, a brand manager on Birds Bees might become brand manager or marketing director on Clorox brand and vice versa, or how does it work?
Yes, it is a challenge for us because I think the intent is to have more people in the broader Clorox organization have a chance to work in this business. But practically, the issue that we deal with is most people that want to go to work for Clorox in the Bay Area of Northern California don't really have a desire to live in the southeastern part of the U.S. and vice versa. So it's less about you know, not wanting to work on those types of business. It's more the practical reality of geography. And
on the other hand,
the people that do come here, what binds us all together is what we call the greater good business model. And there are three kind of legs to it. So there's a whole stream around health and wellness. There's a whole stream around environmental sustainability, and there's a whole stream around corporate responsibility or corporate citizenship. And those are the three sort of legs to the to our cultural stool. And typically people come in here because they are just basically interested in either all three of those things or some combination of one or two of them. And they end up being teachers in one and learners in the other ones that they want to develop. And very rarely do we get a lot of people that are fully developed, fully operational on every single one of those things. But we do get a lot of people that come in pretty developed on one of them. I'm personally more of a health and wellness person. And I've learned more about environmental sustainability than, you know, in the 10 years that I've been here. There is an expectation that that we are walking the talk on these values here. This isn't just something that we put on websites and on Facebook pages, that when people come through these doors, they need to see the manifestation and feel it within the culture of this business.
And so how does the hiring work? Do you hire your own people? Does it go centrally through Clorox? And where do they typically come from?
It goes in different places. We do get in different departments. Like Clorox has amazing capabilities in a variety of different sort of departments as a $5 billion multinational company. And so as we've tried to build capability in, say, the product supply organization, for example, in quality systems or in the R&D department on regulatory aspects, we basically import that capability from people that are working in Oakland. Based on where we are in the southeastern part of the U.S. and the proximity to Duke University and the University of North Carolina, there are very well-developed brand management and marketing communication disciplines within both of those schools. A lot of times those students will leave and they'll go to bigger cities for their first job or two out of school, but they have such an affinity for the lifestyle in Northern California
or North Carolina,
North Carolina, Durham, that they want to come back mid-career. So we get a lot of mid-career returners that want to come back. And, you know, we understand the motivation to want to get back geographically, but what we spend a lot of time interviewing on is cultural fit and affinity with those either health and wellness, environmental sustainability, or corporate citizenship aspects of the job that we expect people to come in here and contribute to.
You are in an interesting, if not challenging, position because you are part of a big mass manufacturer. I think most of these companies, and we both know them, we've worked for Unilever and Procter & Gamble, and Clorox is the holder of this brand. How do you balance what I'm sure is a request for return on investment, efficiency, with preserving or evolving the soul of this brand, which seems to come geographically and philosophically from a different corner?
It's a great question, and that's really an area where this has changed in 20 years. First of all, there are very few founder-owned and operated businesses anymore, right? They get to a certain size, and it just really outstrips the ability of that founder. So whether your portfolio is owned by the Clorox company or Unilever or Procter & Gamble or one of the major multinational manufacturers, or whether you're part of a private equity portfolio or something else, typically these businesses have stakeholders and are part of, you know, broader organizations. There are very few businesses that are maybe larger than $10 or $20 million in revenue that are still run by the founders anymore, just because the complexity of those businesses outstrips the ability of those people to run them the way that they got them off the ground. The second thing is we run our model based on the greater good model has three aspects. We call it good for you, good for us, and good for all. The good for you part really cuts to our belief in the natural formulations, and a natural product is better for the way your skin works, and I could go into that in depth. The good for all part cuts to our environmental sustainability, the way we deal with our employees, and the way we deal with our supplier base. So it's really about the responsibility of businesses as the most powerful force on earth to actually do good things for, you know, the communities and people that they work with. But the good for us part, we don't shy away from. We make a profit. We call it doing well by doing good. And we return a return on investment to our shareholders, whether they're our corporate parent today, whether our previous private equity holder, or to whomever. And we call it being a sustainable business. If you're a nonprofit business, nobody's going to want to invest in you. And, you know, we take the investment that we get from other people and we turn it into product development. We turn it into hiring the 280 people that work in this business, and we turn it into upgrading the capital in our manufacturing facilities and our offices. I think this idea that doing good things and being a financially viable, profitable business are mutually at odds, they're just not anymore.
Well, I talked to Patagonia, and there may be one of those exceptions that you talked about, which is it's a fairly sizable brand. Yeah. We don't know their sales, but my guess would be they're probably in $1 billion or close to that. Mm-hmm. And they're still privately owned, but they do have a professional CEO. They feel that most of brands like them, once they get sold, whether it's to private equity or to other companies, they just can't stick to their original beliefs anymore because some decisions are very, very long term, or they might never pay out. And a private owner might not mind that because they live for this bigger good and they're quite fine with even smaller return, but a corporate owner might not have that. Do you ever get into conflict with your corporate owner where you say, this is an investment I want to make, I can't tell you whether it's going to pay out or not, but it is important for our mission? And who wins, or how is it decided who wins?
The biggest one that we've dealt with here and that we've spoke about previously, so I can talk about it, is we had a healthy debate over the decision to take this business and enter into China. Mm-hmm. Right. So China is a big market for natural products for a lot of reasons. They love Burt's Bees. There's actually a parallel import system already going into China. And there's actually a surprising amount of brand awareness. And clearly, it's a big market that everybody wants to be in. And this brand should be there. China, however, is one of the only remaining countries on the planet that still requires animal testing for imported cosmetics. Mm-hmm. And so there was some debate and discussion over whether or not to do that, the pros and cons of it, the knock-on impact if we were to do it into other markets that we trade in on the brand equity overall. And it was a pretty clear decision not to go. And so even though we've been owned by the Clorox company now for 8 years, we're still not part of China, and we won't be part of China until we can find a way to access that market without compromising our fundamental belief against animal testing.
And that is big. I lived in Hong Kong, and yeah. Burt's Bees is huge there, so it would project that you should be a big hit in China as well.
Well, there's a serious belief in the power of herbal remedies in traditional Chinese medicine, and they have a fundamental respect and admiration for the elderly in general. They don't even call it Burt's Bees. They call it grandfather's bees because of Burt's picture on the label.
Right.
And it's the process of working through that issue with whether it's a corporate parent, whether a private equity firm, or any other stakeholder is just a healthy debate.
Interesting. We've talked a lot about Chinese being really keen on natural materials. We've got a great case study in a brand you might know. It's called Yuan Soap, mm-hmm. which uses, you know, Taiwanese herbal ingredients for soaps and a lot of other things, including toothpaste and yeah. so on and so on. But another aspect that surprised me, this cult around Burt, the person, and he went to Taiwan and he's being received like a star with the press and the bloggers going wild when he visited, I guess, a couple of years ago. How do you literally deal with Burt and the heritage? Also knowing, I guess, that you need to evolve it, right? Because he died and he's been out of this business a long time ago. So between myth and keeping it alive, but also wanting to be authentic and real and not just tell fantasy stories, how do you do that?
It's a great question. And it was easier when Burt was alive because Burt still did appearances for the company.
And he liked it,
and
right?
And he enjoyed it.
Right.
He would complain about it up until the point he got there, and then he would always have a good time doing it. The important thing about Burt is to really make sure you manage this combination of personality and eccentricity and principle on the other hand. And when you get those things out of balance, you're in trouble. Because if you get too principled, you seem preachy and holier than thou, and you know it's a turnoff to people. But if you get too personality and eccentricity driven, you become novelty and not serious enough and kind of, you know, not serious. One of the biggest things we did was a documentary film that we actually produced. It's a 90-minute biopic of Burt.
So you actually did the documentary?
Well, we worked with a filmmaker who was interested in the story.
But it was commissioned by you?
And actually had the idea. It was actually commissioned by him, but we had to agree to it. The test for me was when that film was finished and was showcased at the Toronto Film Festival in 2013, I think it was, there's a couple people that have traveled with Burt for decades and know him really well. And I went to those people and I said, what do you think? And this guy, Brooks, who traveled extensively with Burt, said, that's probably the most accurate representation of what the guy was really like that I've ever seen. So when people ask me, like they always do, what was he like? I just tell them to watch the film because that's exactly what he is. And for me, that's the ultimate compliment because we didn't spin his personality or his principles into something for marketing purposes. We told the true story of what the guy's really happens to be like. The result of that is that there's marketing value in that. So this, again, it goes back to this idea of authenticity. We wanted to tell the authentic story of what he was really like, including the less savory parts or the parts that you know other people may polish down or
what
not
are some of those?
Oh, making appearances at Target stores or things like that, or his relationship with the other founder, the salacious romantic parts of their relationship and then breakup and all of that. We're not interested in that part of the story, but it is part of the story, and we didn't edit it out.
So, what role then does this story and Bird play today, and maybe in 5 years from now? What is his role?
So we do three things. We knew that it's important for us to carry on the legacy. And so we do have a Bert Lives On sort of legacy project, which has three things. First of all, we have our classic line of products, which are the things that were developed in the 80s and 90s that we haven't touched formula or packaging. And we promote them and market them the same way that they were originally created. And we put a lot more of Bert into the marketing of the classic products. The second thing is...
So this is like the icon. It's almost like the storytelling piece.
Like the original things that Bert and Roxanne formulated together back in the old days, right, using the tools that they had.
And you've got the beehive outside the office that actually people walk by on the way to a parking garage here. And
that's the second part, which is when Bert died, we bought the house that he lived on his land in Maine. And we deconstructed it in Maine and we've relocated it to our office in North Carolina. Almost like a shrine to two things. One is... we'll do a lot of content which allow people to sort of see the land and sort of in a virtual reality way be in nature like it was on Bert's land. On the other part, it does all of the minimalist living that Bert was really part of, the doing more with less and only what you need, not what you want.
Do you practice this in the office in some ways?
Yeah, I think that this is a company who at its DNA, the people who not only work here but in their normal lives try to reduce, reuse, and recycle as much as they possibly can. So it's more of just it's an orientation that people just have in general.
Now, the bees are, some say, endangered. You go to great lengths geographically to get wax that is not polluted, you told me, in Africa, etc. Isn't there a point where you almost have to abandon your roots? How is this scalable?
It's completely scalable. The nice thing about this industry is as it's grown, the supply base has now come along with it, whether it's fragrance manufacturers or raw material suppliers. The sophistication that you see in this building on product development and, the development of product and packaging actually has had the same effect back through the supply chain because there's a market for it now that didn't happen to be there before. And so, when 20% of American women, so to speak, in this category self-identify with the profile that I laid out before, which is we call them healthy living advocates. That is, 15 or 20% of the American adult population right now. Basically, what's happened through the supply chain is it's caught up in this, this stuff is available. The issue of the bees is a vexing problem that's been going on since 2006, primarily in North America and Europe, where in any given year, up to 40% of the bee population just vanishes.
Yes.
And frankly, we spend a lot of time and energy, like our entire foundation, and most of the cause-related work we do goes to things which are at the intersection of human and honeybee health. There are four potential issues. The misuse of pesticides, mites that are in this, bacteria that are found in hives, and the mismanagement of these commercial hives that are moving around the countries to do crops, citrus crops in Florida and then almond crops in California. Either one or a combination of those factors is probably the reason why the 40% of the bee population is dying off every year, and they haven't been able to crack it.
Foundation. Is it like at Ben & Jerry's? Is there a certain percentage that goes to the foundation?
Yeah, a percentage of our e-commerce sales funds the foundation.
Okay, and that is fixed, and you advertise that on the e-commerce site?
And in our, we have an integrated annual report and corporate social responsibility report.
How important is social media for you and e-commerce?
Yeah, social media is important. This business has been built historically based on two things. One is public relations, which in the old days used to be what the beauty press wrote about you, but today has really evolved to be influencers more broadly, including social media and bloggers and YouTubers and things like that. So the whole idea of public relations, earned media, and social media has helped to catapult the brand. We can say how authentic and good we are, but when somebody else says it about us, it's much more powerful and believable. And so we value what others say about us more than what we say about ourselves.
E-commerce is a big part of your business. Is a substantial part of your business?
E-commerce is an emerging channel in skincare in general and in natural products in particular. Because the thing for us is, and like you've seen walking around the building and even talking to me down in the store, there's a depth to the education that's required here that doesn't necessarily translate into a print ad or to a billboard. And we love e-commerce because it really is, it's right next to really rich, detailed content on the web that people can get into whatever level of detail that they need. But it's also one click away from buying product and have it show up in your door within 2 days. So it's that combination of commerce plus education, which, you know, we find a hard time matching anywhere other than a store that we might run.
And you told me a wonderful anecdote about how to show that your product is different when you bring bloggers and journalists to your lab. Tell me that story about pregnant women being able to work in your lab.
Well, yeah, so we are here in Durham, North Carolina. You know, most of the skincare industry is in the New York metropolitan area, and we're not really on the beaten path. But we bring a lot of people to our building because we can describe what we're doing, but it comes to life a lot more when you come here through the doors and you walk through the building and you go to the manufacturing site and you see it. And one of the particular areas of interest to people is our R&D lab. So we run our R&D lab right in the middle of the marketing floor. So we have 8 bench chemists that do all of the formulation for all of our products right there in that lab. And it's a way for the beauty press to see it in action. And the two things that they noticed are there's no vents or hoods or anything else to take away any of the noxious sort of harmful fumes that sometimes can be related to skincare formulations. You just don't have that when all you're doing is heating, cooling, and mixing waxes, butters, and other natural ingredients. The second thing is they were surprised by how many pregnant women are working in R&D, because usually in a synthetic skincare company, oftentimes a person can only work on the R&D bench for the first 3 months of pregnancy because they're exposed to so many chemicals. Whereas in a natural products development organization, they can work right up until they give birth because they're not exposed to any ingredients that have potential suspected human health risks.
So I assume those stories are strong stories for
So for us, what we love it is it's a real practical, tangible manifestation of this combination of the sophistication of the science behind natural products and how far that's come in the last 2 decades, but also the gentleness and the old school way of formulating, heating, mixing the products the way that they've always been done.
And I smell like a baby because you made me try this diaper cream and baby powder, and it is really quite an amazing product. I guess there's also a lot in trying to believe, really.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest hurdle we have to get over as a company. I mean, people still remember the days of buying natural peanut butter where you had to stir it up and mix the oil that would separate. The formulations and the aesthetics behind these products, we believe, are as good or better than the leading synthetic products. You don't have to make those aesthetic trade-offs either in the color of the color cosmetics
trade-off
or the way it feels on your skin.
Well, I know you have to make some town hall appearances here, so thanks a lot even more for all your time. If people want to connect with Burt's Bees, what's the best way? Should they watch the film first?
The film is free on Netflix. It's called Burt's Buzz. It's 88 minutes long, and most people find it quite engaging and entertaining. We've got a website. We have a very active Facebook page where we respond to consumers that engage with us on that or Twitter.
Excellent. Well, thanks again so much.
Thanks for
having us here. And you, dear listener, of course, you can always engage with us on uberbrands.com. Like us, rate us, comment. That's what keeps us going. And I hope you'll enjoy this episode and will enjoy the next one. Until then, goodbye. Tschüss.